Hey guys, and welcome to the Pressure's Off podcast from the Student Ministry at Grace Church in Wichita Falls, Texas. Students are under constant pressure to perform, to fit in, to measure up, but in Christ, the pressure's off. And today, Caleb Carmichael has joined us to share his testimony.
What's up, guys?
What's up, dude?
Man, I'm so excited to be here. This is so fun.
I'm so glad you are. Yeah. First time.
First time, long time listener, first time caller.
Yeah, exactly. And and there's Jeff.
I was just walking by, and here I am.
There he is. Jeff's going to join us for our game, but he won't be around for the testimony part. But we're glad you're here for the game.
Do be determined.
We're gonna make sure he's not around. You know. So, yeah, we're glad Caleb's here. We just had our senior testimonies on Wednesday nights, and so I thought it's a great time to have a testimony episode on the podcast.
Yeah.
So
excited to be here.
All right, here's my question for you guys. It's a fun one. I like this question. Say you woke up tomorrow morning, all right? You woke up. I mean,
I hope so.
Hopefully you do wake up.
It's on the agenda.
Pretend you woke up tomorrow morning.
I'll try to imagine.
And you find that you can now freeze time for everyone but yourself. Ooh. For 1 hour a day.
Mm.
Forever.
Mm.
What are you doing? Not forever. Not what are you going to do every single day,
yeah.
But what comes to mind? What would you do if you could freeze time for everyone but yourself for 1 hour a day? How would you use that?
My first instinct is that I would become a really good thief, and then I'm thinking my morals and my conscience wouldn't let me do that.
Yeah, pastor turned thief. Hey, listen. Don't know. Did you know this is a church podcast?
No, is that?
Oh. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Okay.
Caleb Carmichael would become
second thought thief. After thief, after my conscience says, no, that's a bad idea, is I think I could become a really good spy. Because imagine you freeze time. I can go in and do whatever I need to do to find all the secret information and get paid handsomely for that. So that then I can come back and live my normal life.
Yeah.
And the other 6 days of a week, what I've planned to do is take a nap. Because,
yes,
because if I can pause... time at 2 p.m, take an hour nap,
dude,
and then back to my day and no one knows. That's
100%
so clutch.
I will say, to be a spy, like, that would be a very interesting interview process. How do you interview for that? Like, how do you convince someone you're not a crazy?
I think you just say, like, watch, give me something to find and I'll do it.
Give me something to find.
Something to see. Again, I'm coming back to thievery, but I'm stealing information instead of monetary.
Yeah, I like it.
I don't know.
You only have 1 hour though, so it's got to be a local mission.
Yeah, of course.
They're like, okay, go to Pakistan, and you're like, okay, hold up, it only lasts for an hour, so give me like a week.
Yeah,
the first hour I'll probably be in the plane.
Yeah,
but we can talk later.
That's right.
Yeah. That's hilarious. All right, Jeff, what would you do?
I think that moment of sunrise when it first peaks up over the horizon, I'm going to push my freeze button so that I know my phone's not going to ring. Nobody's going to need me. I just get to sit there and watch that. I feel some guilt about, I guess that's how it works, stealing the sunrise from everybody else in the world.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm going to do.
No, they'd get it after the hour was up.
Oh, so they're like an hour behind?
Well,
I don't think it pauses.
Yeah, it would pause time for everybody everywhere. It pauses like... the time of the world.
Okay.
Except for you.
So you can enjoy the
sunrise.
Okay, well,
I'll let it get up a little bit higher then.
There you go. Yeah.
Before you know what, though? That's a great thought. You could use this like an extra snooze button if you wanted to.
Oh, just link it to the
alarm. Like, as soon as your alarm goes off and your girls are kind of, I'm thinking about my girls. Like, you know, they start moving and talking. My daughters, yes.
Yes.
I press the snooze button immediately and just pause time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sleep is my answer in some form or fashion, whether it's a nap day or a snooze day.
Yeah, my first thought was, as soon as I'm headed home to work or headed home from work, I pause time.
Hmm.
And then I can just, it may not be a nap. Maybe it's just I go sit outside for an hour by myself. No, that's
do whatever
the thing.
You want to
There's
do.
There's no noise because no one's driving. There's nothing happening. It's complete silence. Like, that sounds amazing.
Sounds great.
Fun stuff. All right. Well, guys, let's move on to our game. All right. So since Jeff has joined us here for this game, we're going to do a three-round draft. Three-round. Maybe four if this goes fast, but usually it doesn't. So three-round draft right now.
Okay.
Here's the prompt. Do y'all know what a draft is, by the way?
I do.
I have familiarity with sports.
Were you on the draft that we had with...
Yeah, we took Bible people.
Okay, you were. Okay, good. So snake draft. Okay. Yeah, so like Caleb, you'll be first pick.
Okay.
We'll go this way. Jeff's the last pick.
Okay.
After, but he'll pick twice and it'll come back around.
Got it.
Okay.
Yep.
Here's the prompt. A billionaire just revealed to the entire nation that he's hidden a treasure chest somewhere in Texas filled with $500 million. He's just hidden it. Draft a team of three people you believe could find the chest before everyone else.
Oh, three people or four? Because it changes my answer.
Three people now. Because, see, Jeff's joined us here. So I don't know how long, it might be four. If we do this quickly, we'll add another round to it.
Okay.
But again, he's revealed to the nation. He's gone on the news.
Yep.
His video's going viral on social media. Everyone's like, whoa, I got to go find this treasure chest of $500 million. What three people are you drafting? But also, here's the other thing.
Real people?
That's what I was about to say. It can be real or fictional, but the fictional characters cannot have superpowers.
So if you draft Superman, he's just a dude.
Correct.
Yeah. Just Clark Kent.
Just Clark Kent.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. All right. First, I get first pick?
You get first pick.
Okay. Here's my first pick is Elon Musk, and here's why. He's filthy rich, so he has resources.
That's a good pick.
He has an ego, so I can pitch this as, hey, this other billionaire thinks you can't do this, and that'll motivate him to use all of his resources to go after this thing. So Elon Musk is my first because he's got all the tech, all the ego, and all the money to make this happen.
That's good. That's a good pick. Jeff's struggling here because if you don't know, Jeff's been on several podcast episodes, and Jeff is like Mr. Prepare Ahead of Time, put so much thought into this.
Yeah, and I just got to know.
Yeah.
Nope.
So my pick is going to be the best detective of all time, Sherlock Holmes.
Ooh. Yeah. I like that choice.
Sherlock Holmes, he'll discover, I may not even need anyone else. He may be able to get it done by himself.
I'm just going to say I'm thinking off the cuff, and you took both of mine that I've come up with so far.
Yes. You could take the second.
Okay, so I'm going to take Jeff Bezos from Amazon in an attempt just to keep up with Elon Musk. And he's got a drone army that could be helpful with that.
It's very true. It's a good
drone
pick.
Army, yeah. Man, those Amazon drones.
And now, Jeff, we're doing snake, right? So Jeff again. Yep. Yeah. Okay.
Jeff wasn't prepared. To be fair, I wasn't either. I didn't even really think through this.
I will take Chuck Norris.
Ooh, I like
a little
that.
While ago before he died.
Yes,
living.
You, so
living
you do
Chuck prime Norris. Okay. Chuck Norris.
Yeah,
you want old Chuck Norris.
Yeah, because he's going to fend off anyone else who's maybe getting close to it.
Yeah,
as we're nearby.
This is good. Huh. That's a good pick. I like that.
It was a desperation pick, but
I just thought. I mean, no offense, but he's your bodyguard. you pick Chuck Norris.
Why not?
No.
Are you too young to appreciate?
No. I appreciate prime Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris.
He chose old Chuck Norris.
No, I meant like in the past old, not like aged, not elderly Chuck Norris.
There it is. Okay.
Yeah. That makes so much more sense.
Chuck Norris that was.
You're like, I'm going to pick that Chuck Norris like, you know, the week before he died as my bodyguard.
Point taken.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you went the same route. I got to think of a bodyguard here. And so I'm going to pick Jason Bourne.
Mm.
And what's good about Jason Bourne is he's got both. Mm. I feel like, unlike John Wick, who's really just the bodyguard, Jason Bourne had to solve some stuff.
Yes.
And fought people off. So
he had to solve some stuff with amnesia.
Yeah. Did a great job with it.
Great job. Imagine if he knows
good job.
Everything.
Good job, Mr. Bourne.
Yep.
If you're listening to this podcast.
Way to be. All right. My next pick is the world's best hacker because...
Whoever that is.
Whoever that is, which we don't know, but that's my pick because...
That's good.
The billionaire did not hide this treasure on his own.
Yeah.
There is for sure an electronic trail of people he hired and places he mapped out. And so this hacker will get the location immediately.
Mm. I just thought it was funny that you didn't offer a name. Hey, he's out there somewhere. Whoever you are,
So
you've got best hacker in the world.
The best hacker in the world does.
The first pick was
no one knows his name. Elon.
Elon. Okay. Yep. I need to write these down.
Yep.
Keep talking because you got another pick.
Oh, I do have another pick. Oh, so okay. So let's see.
They can hear me typing.
If I have. Okay. My next pick is Neil Caffrey from the television hit show White Collar.
Yes.
Because Neil Caffrey is a con artist, art forger, is legendary in finding treasure. So much so that he found and replicated and stole the treasure off of a Nazi submarine. So if he can do that, he can.
No, that's good.
He can find this. And the benefit of Neil Caffrey is that he comes with the FBI backing and protection. So there's my bodyguard is the FBI built that's in with
good,
Neil Caffrey.
That's a good pick. Did you have that one already like ready?
Oh yeah.
Okay. That's a good show. White Collar's fun. Elon, best. I think we can do four rounds because he's already done technically. We're gonna go four rounds.
That's all I need though. Yeah. I need those three. I'm good.
But. Elon, best hacker, Neil Caffrey. Solid team so far. I've got Sherlock and Jason Bourne. All right. Third pick. I really like this duo. I think maybe if I had two more, they're going to get in the way. But with that being said, I am going to take the president of the United States, Donald Trump. Now, listen, I'm picking Donald Trump because of the sheer resources at his disposal.
That's fair.
The president of the United States, I would have taken the president of the United States no matter who it is.
That's a good point.
They just had so many resources at their disposal, know so many secrets, can call shots. I'm taking...
That's a good pick.
Donald Trump. Donald Trump, Sherlock Holmes, and Jason Bourne in a room together. Oh, that's funny. All right, Jeff.
There's a joke there. I don't know what it is. There's one there. Do we know what form this $500 million is in? Is it
gold
currency?
Gold coins.
It's gold coins.
Like old style pirate Balloons. Treasure.
Yeah. Mm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well... I'm going to take the current head of the NSA, technically he works for Trump, but
yeah,
that whole awesome. Like, hey, requisition some satellite footage for me and just let me sit back and watch where this billionaire went to take his money. Like, I'm going to pull that footage.
What's his name?
I don't know. He's friends with the best hacker in the world.
Director That's right. Of yeah. He actually probably employs the best hacker in the world.
Yeah, he might be the best hacker in the world.
You said director of the NSA.
Yes.
Joshua M. Rudd.
There you go.
Josh. That's who I was thinking of.
Let's look up the best hacker in the world. Director of the NSA. Got it. Okay. And you get to go again. This is your last pick. This is actually the last pick.
You know what? My best friend.
Oh,
you stole my answer. What?
That's good, Jeff.
Jeff, I don't want to just hang out with these three guys that I don't know best while they do friend. Cool stuff.
Yeah,
I want to enjoy it. I want to share it.
That's good, but that's also the route I was going. Was that
Leland Wetzel was my next. Yeah, pick.
Oh, man,
you guys really cannot good. Take my best friend.
Yeah, there we go.
I know. So. Can I say Jesus?
No, you can't. I actually was going to come there and say you can't say Jesus. I think Jesus.
Does
Jesus
he get to keep say, his powers? I mean,
yeah, Jesus is Jesus. Yes,
so, but you can't. Yeah, you can't have Which his powers.
Not, yeah, so. Yeah, he wouldn't be able to like.
No, he said
pinpoint.
Fictional guys couldn't have their powers.
Oh, that's just true.
And he probably wouldn't even want me to find
where
the chest
your treasure
of gold.
Is. There, your heart.
Yeah,
would be
exactly.
Also.
He'd probably be like, "Hey, this isn't a great mission. I'd rather not be drafted for this team.
I've taken your heart out of your body, and I've put it where the treasure is."
Oh, I can't take Jesus. Okay, then I'm taking. I'm taking Peter.
Peter.
Yep. Again, for similar reasons.
Yeah.
You know, he's kind of got this some leadership qualities about him.
Similar reasons as if Peter's your best friend.
That's a great point. I'm not taking Peter because I think he'll actually help me find the treasure chest.
Yeah.
I'm taking him because now I've got this guy who's with me that. Man, I can ask him some questions. He'll speak up. He's going to try. He's going to be helpful, attempt to be helpful. Yeah.
But if
Peter
you get,
the Apostle specifically, because there's a lot of Peters out there.
You just Jesus juked this whole thing.
If like, you get,
I'm going to take Peter so I can have a really spiritual conversation.
If you get Peter, though, to look over there and there's not any treasure there, you might get Jesus to be like, hey, look over there. Mm. And you're going to find a ton.
Well, I can't take Jesus. So.
It's true.
You might come along with Peter, though.
Last pick. Yo, you already said
Leland Wetzel because I recently went on a 28-hour road trip with him, and it was really fun. Yeah. So I figure a treasure hunt with him would
That's
also
a
be
really long road trip.
Yeah.
Goodness.
So
okay.
Treasure hunt sounds fun with Leland.
So Caleb Carmichael got Elon, best hacker, Neil Caffrey, and Leland Wetzel. I've got Sherlock, Jason Bourne, Donald Trump, and Peter the Apostle. Jeff's got Bezos, Chuck Norris, the director of the NSA, and his best friend. It's good. I don't really know who wins there, but that's fun. All right, guys, let's jump into our core discussion today.
I'm out. Peace.
Bye, Jeff.
See you, Jefe.
We love you. Oh, man, the room just got sadder.
It did.
I mean, he's technically in here getting up right now, but no longer on the mic.
There he goes.
Bye, Jeff. So I said at the beginning, but I am grateful for you being here, Caleb. Again, we had our testimonies on Wednesday nights. Our seniors, it's an opportunity for them to come up to the front on a Wednesday and share with all of their peers the work that God has done in their lives.
Yeah.
And so I thought it would be great for us to have a story of faith here on the podcast. And so here's kind of where I just want to start. And honestly, this is your story of faith. So I don't want to just throw questions at you. In some ways, you can start talking.
Okay.
And if it's flowing, I may just interject and be like, hey, can you share with us ... but maybe start with the big one. When did you place your faith in Jesus?
Yeah.
And kind of what led to that moment? And
sure. Yeah. I was pretty young. I was probably around 8 years old. I was a pretty good kid growing up. It wasn't like I had this big rebellious streak that all of a sudden I realize I have whatever, I need to turn my life around at eight.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
I'm imagining Millie but, six, but
yeah,
I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but I did have this moment. We were at my grandparents' church in Oklahoma with me and my mom, and had this moment of just understanding that I had sinned. Like I have done things wrong.
Yeah.
And recognizing that God wanted to forgive me and that was possible because of Jesus. And so we talked with my mom and pastor there at that church about placing my faith in Jesus, trusting in Jesus, that he could forgive me of my sins and wanted to do that and wanted to forgive me and heal me and make me whole. And, and an 8-year old plus mind, I probably wouldn't have used those exact words,
right,
but just had this understanding that I needed Jesus.
Yeah.
So
you've lived a lot of life since you were 8.
I've lived a lot of life since I was 8. Yes.
Yeah. So we're not going to have time to walk through every year, right, of your life.
Year
so let's,
nine.
Let's try and hit some of the pivotal moments. Like, as you've considered your story, you place your faith in Jesus when you're 8 years old, and there's a lot that's happened. Like, what are some of those pivotal moments in your life that you felt God used to shape and form your faith, how they impacted your life after that?
Yeah. So thinking specifically of students, when I'm in middle school and high school, I was still a pretty good kid. I was a rule follower. I tried to do all the right Christian things.
Yeah.
And yet at the same time, I was just mad at the world. Had a broken relationship with my dad. I was mad at him. I was mad at God. I was just mad.
Yeah.
And so while I talked a lot about following Jesus and did follow Jesus, I also had this really big part of my life that wasn't engaged with him at all.
Yeah.
Because I'm so angry. And when I was 17, and I felt this call to ministry, and I didn't really know what that meant. Just sitting in church one day, had this pretty clear moment of feeling like the Lord was saying, this is what I want you to do with your life. Mm. And that was a really big moment for me of setting a trajectory for the course of my life. Yeah. And at the same time, I feel this call to ministry, and I have friends who will joke. They're like, yeah, Caleb on a Sunday morning talked about, yeah, I'm going to go after ministry. I'm going to pursue ministry. Mm. And then Tuesday night I get ejected from a basketball game for fighting. Like I didn't have it all figured out. Right. And it's still dumb.
That is so funny.
And so I'm living, almost this double life with this talking about God's love and then feeling this anger. And then when I was a freshman in college, I was 19, the Lord used a really crazy moment in my life to change the trajectory.
How old were you again? Sorry.
19 years 19, old. Okay. Yeah. And so when I was 19, I am at home in between classes at college, and a buddy of mine, his name is Cody, he came over to the house. And Cody, we had been friends since middle school, all through high school. And Cody in high school had made some choices that led him down a pretty bad path. Fallen in with not a great group of people, started doing drugs, eventually dropped out of high school. So I'm a freshman in college. Cody shows up at the house one day, and he comes inside, and immediately I can tell something is off with him. And so start talking to him, and you know, he admits to me, he's telling me he's been tweaking on meth for days, hadn't slept in days, and is just kind of out of it. And so we're just kind of hanging out. At this time, I'm living with my friend Stefan at his house.
Mm-hmm. Were you in this moment, were you already pretty cautious?
I was somewhat cautious, okay. Somewhat just, you know, I wasn't sure what to do. It was,
and you hadn't seen him in a while.
I hadn't seen him in a while. It's almost at this point just more awkward than anything, yeah. Because it's hard to have a conversation with him. It's hard to engage. He's not making a ton of sense. He keeps asking where Stefan is, where Stefan's parents are, and so you can just, the vibes were off, right? Mm-hmm. Something's just this isn't right, and so. I'm trying to call Stefan, trying to get a hold of his parents, trying to figure out something to do with Cody here. Eventually, after a while, we go to watch TV, and he asks if we, you know, have any snacks, anything to drink. So we go into the kitchen, and in their kitchen they had a pantry, and so I open up the pantry to see what we have. And when I do, I turn my back on Cody, pretty much for the first time since mm-hmm. he's been home. And when I turned my back on him, he pulls a knife out of his pocket that he had brought with him and slits my throat. Big one side to the other, a big 10, 11 inch gaping goodness slice across my throat. And in the very first moment, I don't realize what's going on. It doesn't hurt immediately. And so in my head, it's like he's messing with me, like putting me in a headlock or something, you know, and so I reach up.
That's wild to me.
It's wild to me too. I reach up and like go to grab what I think is just going to be his arm, and with one hand grab his arm and another hand I kind of cut my finger on the knife that's still up there, and I realize that I am now covered in blood. And so I start wrestling, kind of fighting with Cody. I kind of grab one arm and kind of throw him over my shoulder, and we're on the ground wrestling, kind of trying to get this knife away from him and all of these things. And I'm yelling and screaming, like, what are you doing? What are you doing? And my friend Stefan, they had someone who was there cleaning their house. Her name was Lynn. And so she hears the commotion. She hears me screaming. And so she comes or kind of around the corner and sees us on the ground fighting and covered in blood. And so she screams.
Yeah.
And when she screams, it kind of gets Cody's attention. And so Cody, we kind of stop fighting. He stands up and he goes one way out of the kitchen. And I stand up and put my hand up to my throat. And my finger actually goes inside of my throat at that point.
My word.
And so I go the other way out of the kitchen into this hallway foyer area that has a mirror, and I can see in the mirror this slice across my throat, and can see the blood pumping out. And so I take my shirt off and I tie it around my neck to try to slow the bleeding down. And then I step back around the corner.
In that moment, did you feel like even then?
Yeah, when
I probably the like.
So die. Yeah, in that moment when I saw that, you know, the first thought is, oh, this is not good.
Yeah.
This is very bad.
Yeah.
I don't know that I was quite at the point of, I think I'm going to die. I got there, but step back around the corner. And at that point, Cody had gone to Stefan's parents' closet and found Stefan's grandfather's old revolver and is now holding Lynn mm-hmm. at gunpoint, threatening to shoot her, and he's yelling at her, screaming at her to shut up. Wow. And so I yell his name to get his attention off of Lynn and back onto me. And so he turns at me, and Lynn kind of gets out the back door, and then he's walking at me, pointing the gun at me. And in that moment, this is the moment when I'm like, I am going to die. Whether it's from him, you know, cutting my throat, or he's about to shoot me. And mm-hmm. so in that moment, it feels kind of silly to say this, but I'm having this moment of like, I don't want you to shoot me because this already hurts so much, and I don't want to hurt anymore. And so I'm just telling him, I'm like, Cody, don't shoot me. You've already killed me. You don't need to shoot me. And when I say that, it's like,
you said that.
Yeah, I said that. Like, you've already killed me. Wow. You don't need to shoot me. And in that moment, it's like a switch flipped in his mind, and he starts freaking out because he's like, what have I done? What have I done? Oh my goodness, I can't believe, like, I've killed you. I'm going to go to prison. What have I done? And then he starts holding the gun to his own head, threatening to kill himself. Mm. And so then in that moment, I have this fear that I'm about to watch a really good friend of mine kill himself. And part of the irony of this whole story is that when I was 16, Cody and I were at the lake together, and I had gone on a rope swing off of a dock, and the rope broke, and I fell and hit my head on the dock and knocked myself unconscious in water that was 30 feet deep. And Cody had dove in the water and grabbed me and pulled me out and saved my life.
That saved your life just three years
before that. So wow. he had literally saved my life. And so I have this guy that I've known since sixth grade, who I've been friends with this whole time, who literally saved my life. And now he's threatening to kill himself right in front of me.
Wow.
And I'm just thinking, I don't want him to do that. And so, I keep telling him, Cody, you need to put the gun down. You don't need to kill yourself. You know, just put the gun down. Like, Cody, I need to call an ambulance for me, but I'm not going to do that until you put the gun down. Until eventually he finally like lowers the gun. He lowers it away from his head and kind of is just holding it down by his mm-hmm. side. And at that point, I go and I grab my phone and I call 911. I tell them I need an ambulance, that I've been stabbed. And I hang up.
Forget you made that call.
Yeah, I made that call. And after I hang up with 911, I open the front door of the house, and I lay down in the foyer, because at this point I'm just exhausted, just completely wiped, have no energy left at all, and I'm laying down.
And you've lost a lot of blood.
Yeah, they estimated I lost around 40% of my blood.
My word.
And so, yeah, just blood everywhere, covered in blood. And so I lay down in the foyer to wait for the police. And I call my mom. And at this time, I'm a freshman in college, but my mom, she actually lived in Mississippi at the time, but she had been in town that weekend. So this happened on a Monday. She'd been in town that weekend and was mm-hmm. driving out of town that Monday
yeah.
as this is happening. So I call her. And she answers the phone and she says, "Hey, what's up?" And I said, you need to come home. I've been stabbed. And she says, "What?" And I say, "Just come home." And then I hang up on my mom.
Man.
So my poor mom
has,
that's all she has.
The mother's worst nightmare.
Worst nightmare. Like, you know, no clue the context, no clue what's going on. And I hang up on her because in that moment, Stefan's dad is calling me. He had heard from a friend who had a police scanner that something was happening at his house, at his address. And so he called him, and then dad called me, and he's like, "What's going on? Are you okay?" And like, the only thing I can think of to say at that moment is, well, I'm alive. I'm not okay, but I'm like, I'm alive mm-hmm. and kind of hang up with him. And so then I'm laying there in the foyer. I've called my mom I've talked to Stefan's dad. I'm just sitting there waiting, and Cody is still somewhere behind me in the house. But I, at this point, I can't even really hold my head up, because all of the muscles were cut as well. And so, and I'm laying there waiting. And in that moment, I was 100% certain that I would not get up off that floor. I was like, this is the moment that I'm going to die, waiting on this ambulance to show up. And in that moment, sitting there, sure that I'm going to die, is legitimately the most peaceful moment I've ever had in my entire life. You know, scripture talks about a peace that surpasses understanding. And I know what that feels like, because in that moment, there's no reason that I should have had peace. And yet I did. And it was this just overwhelming sense of, this is going to be okay, because in just a moment, I'm going to be face to face with Jesus. That there's such confidence in life after death, because of Jesus, and the peace that came from Jesus in that moment was such a confirmation of the truth of everything that Jesus has ever said. I've believed in Jesus since I was 8, and yet in that moment it was like Jesus showing me everything you believe is real.
Goodness, that reminds me of not that you were a martyr killed for your faith.
Yeah.
But when I've read stories of martyrs, their faith grounded them right before they met death.
Yeah.
I've yet to find a story of a martyr that there was this like overwhelming hopelessness or anguish,
yeah,
or despair, where they're trying to get out of it. Each story I've read, there's like this calm. Not that there was no pain, but there's this like this supernatural calm and this peace. That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, you would love to say it had anything to do with me, but it didn't, you know. All this peace from Jesus. And so,
man,
I'm laying there waiting to die. And, to my surprise, a police officer walks in the front door. He had been really close by. And so when he gets the call, he shows up, really quickly. And, he walks in and he sees me, and later he would say he thought I was already dead. Like he saw the scene, sees me laying there and with how much blood, and he thought I was done. But I kind of like look up at him and I kind of motion to him, like, and pointing, there's a guy with a gun, like making those motions. Cause in my head, I'm like, I don't want to say Cody's name, cause I'm still somewhat afraid he'll kill himself. And so the officer steps back outside to wait for backup. And eventually more officers show up. They lived on kind of a cul-de-sac at the end of a block. And so they locked the entire block down. And then they kind of come on the bullhorn and say, like, come out with your hands up. Like, I didn't know they actually did that.
Right.
And so I stand up and like walk out the front door and am met by all of these officers with their guns pointing at the door. And they then help me, like one on each arm, like help me. I have to walk down the street to get to the ambulance because the street was locked down.
Oh my word. The fact that you're even able to walk.
It's crazy. And so get to the ambulance, and they start working on me as I'm driving me to the hospital. And in that moment is the first time I have some hope that I might actually not die. That I might actually make it is as we're kind of driving to the hospital. And then the EMT, he's like, let's see what we're working with. And he takes my shirt off, and his response, I can't repeat on this podcast, but it was not an encouraging, not an encouraging response. And so
in that moment, you probably didn't want to hear it.
No. Yeah. Yeah. And so went from this moment of like, oh, maybe I'm going to make it, to, oh, maybe not again. Obviously I do. They get me to the hospital. They take me into surgery. They sew up all of the muscles and all of the things that were cut. Lost count of the number of stitches in the thousands. And then 2 days later I was home. I mean,
wow.
Wow. And so thinking of my story, like that moment is obviously
just a small one.
Just a small one. Just a small. It's an everyday Monday.
Wow.
But I think so much about that moment changed things in my life.
Absolutely.
It was a moment that God used, one, as a wake-up call for me, that, you know, I'd felt this call to ministry, but I wasn't really pursuing that, and I wasn't, it wasn't that I had, like, abandoned my faith and wasn't living for Jesus, right. But I just wasn't passionate about it. I wasn't super engaged, and it was like this moment of, hey, no, wake up. Like, you're not guaranteed tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I know that sounds so cliche, but it really was this, like, hey, don't waste your life moment for me. And even then, through that, the Lord has used that day and the suffering of that day and the suffering that came after that day. You kind of had years of PTSD and nightmares and some months of physical therapy and all of these things to shape me into who I am now. And I think of the suffering in that moment and the suffering of the months and years after that, that God really did use those things to shape who I am and my faith in him. And so when I read James talking about count it joy when you face trials of various kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces this steadfastness, and you let steadfastness have its full effect, I'm like, yeah, I can see that's actually true.
Yeah.
And so I talk about that day as both the worst day of my life and the best day of my life. Mm. I would never want to go through it again. I would never wish it upon anybody. And yet I wouldn't take it away from my story, because God has redeemed so much in my own life and faith and who I am through that really difficult moment. So
what did you, if I need to explain this, let me know. But like, what did you feel toward God after that? Like, Do you feel like it propelled you further toward him, or is there a mixed bag of emotions? Like, why, but also gratitude, you know, what was that?
Yeah. All of those things and in different seasons. So, you know, I think my first response in the days after was just this tremendous, like, gratitude that I was alive. Mm-hmm. And then this isn't towards God, but then I just had fear. I had nightmares and was scared to go to sleep, scared to live in my own home, all of these things. And that wasn't directed at God. It wasn't like, oh, now I'm scared of God, but it was, eventually actually came to that point of, it came to like this point of like, oh, is this always going to be the way how God works in my life and shapes me? So it actually was some fear that came with that of, God, I don't want to go through anything like that again.
Yeah.
And then, yes, I've had seasons of being angry at God for that moment, seasons of why did you let that happen, seasons of why do you still let me face, you know, repercussions from this. But as time has gotten further away from that moment, more and more, it's just a sense of gratitude for the day, for how he's worked in me and after through that. So, yeah.
It may be really hard to pinpoint for you, but what is like one of the biggest ways you feel like a big specific way you feel that shaped your faith?
Yeah.
I'm sure you've found that it's kind of threaded throughout your life in different ways, but what's one big way, if you could pinpoint how it's shaped you?
That's a great question. I think I'm going to give you two. You said one, but yeah. I think one is that day helps me remember that I can trust God even when I don't understand things. I think you see that pattern, especially through the Old Testament, when God is calling his people to remember, remember all of the things that I did for you. Remember how I brought you out of Egypt. Remember how I led you in the wilderness. Remember how I brought you into this land. Remember what I did for you.
Yeah.
And all of the ways I did those things for you were not what you would have expected. And so I feel like in some ways it's my very own remember moment that like God has done so much good through that, like Romans 8:28, that God can work all things together for the good. Like he really has through that. And so in the present, when I am faced with situations and I'm like, I don't have a clue what you're doing, God, like this doesn't make any sense to me. I can, if I'm able to stop and pause and think, I'm like, oh yeah, but remember when you did all of this good from that moment? So that's, maybe that's my one answer right there.
Yeah,
so.
That's good. That's really good. Well, after that.
Yeah.
You finished college.
Finished college.
Yeah. Went into ministry.
Went into ministry. Yeah. Started.
Were you working at a church while you were in college?
Nope. Okay. So shortly after that, I started serving. I didn't come on staff in a church until right as I was graduating with my undergrad. But I wasn't serving anywhere. So I was going to church, but I wasn't being a part of church mm-hmm. in that way. And so I started immediately serving in student ministry after that. I was a sixth grade guys small group
leader. Nice.
And awesome. Was so intimidated by that.
Hey, listen,
so,
get it.
So like, I've never been cool in my life. And so I'm walking in to this group of sixth grade guys.
So cool. That's,
well, I have one cool story. Like now I have a cool story that gives me some street cred. But before that, but it was so intimidating. But what I found, like I found so much joy and fulfillment in serving, and it stretched my faith because, you know, the Lord's going to lead us to do things that lead us out of our comfort zone, yeah. but that actually do require some faith. And so even in serving that way, I was met by the Lord and my faith grew because it was like, God, I can't do this. I don't have anything to offer these boys, which at some level is true. Like I can just point them to Jesus, and yet God would meet me in that by meeting those boys through me. So started serving church, came on staff at a church full time after I graduated, went to seminary, got married while I was at seminary.
That's another pivotal moment.
Another pivotal moment. I got married to my wife, Samantha, who is the best thing that has ever happened to me.
Can you give like a, if you can,
yep.
I just think it's hilarious, like the 20-second version of the first time you asked her out.
Yeah. So I knew Sam in high school. She was a grade ahead of me. And in high school, I had a crush on her. Mm-hmm. I was, again, had no game, was not cool. She didn't know I existed. And so it wasn't until college that I actually worked up the courage to like ask her out.
And, yeah.
And so there's this moment where she's back, it might have even been MySpace, but I think it was Facebook, early days. She's asking if anyone is taking this specific class. And this is my chance. I'm like, I have an in here.
There it is.
This is my chance. I'm not taking the class, but I just finished it. And I have great notes, not that I took, that a friend took. And I'm like, hey, I'm not in it, but I have notes for this class. I'd love to meet up and give them to you. And I'm thinking in that moment, like, here's my chance. We're going to meet. I'm going to give her these notes. She's going to fall madly in love with me because who wouldn't? and I have this whole, like, idea built up of what's about to happen. And so we meet in a building at MSU and walk up to her and I'm like, here are the notes. And she says, okay, thanks, bye. And just immediately turns and walk away before I have a chance to say anything else.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I just blew my shot again. And so it wasn't
so funny.
Yeah. Yeah. But eventually worked up courage again to talk to her again and
it worked out.
And here we are. Here we are.
Married, two kids.
That's right. Married with two kids.
So let's talk about marriage for just a moment here.
Yeah.
Obviously, marriage comes with challenges, yeah. and it pushes you and pulls you in all sorts of different directions. And so, you know, as a husband here, what is something you would want students who may want to be married someday, what would you want them to know?
Yeah. So marriage is going to challenge you. Mm-hmm. I was an only child, and Sam was too. And so we came into marriage both only children.
I don't know if I realized, yeah.
Yeah, which revealed some selfishness on both of our parts.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things, like, I thought I was so mature when I got married and immediately realized I am not mature at all. I have so much selfishness and so much insecurity and so much pride and all of these things that just get exposed when you're living with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true in marriage, and that's true in any relationship, whether you're married or not. Like, if you're in proximity with people, they can be a mirror to you if you allow them to be. Mm-hmm. And so marriage has sanctified me in so many ways. Parenting has done the same thing.
Yep.
It reveals more than anything my own selfishness. Mm-hmm. And the call in Scripture to husbands specifically is to lay down your lives for the sake of your wife and your family.
Yeah.
And on one hand, I think when men, we hear that, we think like this really noble calling to like, I would jump in front of the bullet.
Right.
Which I would, like absolutely would.
It includes that.
It includes that. And actually,
it's so much
that sounds way easier than than the actual day-to-day dying to myself for the sake of my wife and my kids. That's the actual challenge. And so I think of students, especially in middle school and high school, I think of, you know, I dated in middle school and high school, and I think I was so not aware of what love actually was.
Yeah.
I was in those relationships for what I could get out of them, for making me feel better or making me feel loved or whatever. And so to middle school and high school students, I would say, like, I get the world will tell you this is perfectly normal. Like, this, this is what you should do. I would tell you it's not worth it. Like it's most of the time. Like I know that's not everyone's story. I'm sitting here looking at someone whose story is not that, but like from my own experience, would have saved so much heartache, so much drama, so much relational pain to wait until I was at a point to that I could, anyway.
What's funny, when you said like you're looking at someone who, what's funny is if I could go back in time.
Yeah.
I'd look at my parents and be like, hey, listen, don't let little eighth grade Caleb date.
Yeah.
Hey, let that go. Caleb just asked you. Tell him no.
Yeah.
Tell Caleb no. If students are listening to this, like, wait, don't say that out loud. Yeah. It's not worth it.
It's and I get it. I was also middle school and high school me. And but learning through marriage and through parenting how sacrificial love really is. Like love is a giving of yourself. Mm-hmm. And when I was in middle school 100%. And high school, I was not ready to give of myself in a healthy way.
I'm sure you would agree with this. As much as being a husband and being a father has stretched you and you've learned it, or it's exposed selfishness in your heart.
Yeah.
It's also provided a joy that you probably didn't even know existed.
No, for sure. It is incredibly fulfilling and meaningful and has changed all of the priorities of my life in the best way. And of course, like all of those things are great. So of course it's like Sam in my life has been outside of my relationship with Jesus has been the best thing in my life.
Yeah.
And then my kids after that. Yep. And for sure. And I also want to encourage students that, you know, there's Paul and Jesus weren't married. Like, and Paul actually talks about it might be better that you don't be married.
Yes.
And so even this idea that you have to be married in order to find fulfillment, or you have to be married in order to be challenged or stretched in the ways that marriage is challenged and stretched me, I don't think that's true. And I think actually some people are called by the Lord to be single, and that's not a less than calling.
Just to give you an example, my dad, who grew up without a father, he grew up with a father, just not a father figure who loved him well. His mentor, he's been single his whole life.
Yeah.
That's his mentor. That was his father figure.
Yeah.
A man who had never been married, who has made a greater impact on my dad than anybody else in my dad's life.
Yeah.
But,
and so in thinking even now, like you and I know the lack of freedom, and not that we would trade it, but like when you have a wife and kids, you have a responsibility to your wife and kids first and foremost. Like those are the most important things in your life outside of your relationship with the Lord, which means like by nature, you're not free to go wherever the Lord is leading in the way that you would be if you're single. And so especially thinking of like high school students going into college or going into the trades or going into whatever's post high school for them, you have such an opportunity at that age to be incredibly flexible and open-handed with what the Lord might want for you, that if the only thing you're pursuing is trying to find a marriage, you might be missing some incredible work that the Lord wants to do through you in that, even if it's just for that season.
Yeah.
It's incredible, but also there are other things in life that are also incredible.
Yeah,
so
that's good. That's good. Well, I know there's, again, like I said at the beginning, I know there's so much more to your life than even what we've touched on here. But What is, and this might be hard for you too, but what is one thing you hope someone listening would take away from your story?
Yeah.
Like if someone just heard us and they heard this conversation, what's the one thing you'd want them to take away?
So I realize when I tell my story that for most people, it's not super relatable, right? In the sense of, well, I've never had a meth addict slit my throat. Yeah. But what we all have in common is we have all, every single one of us, been faced with situations that are impossible, that we don't know what to do, that we don't see how it's going to work out, that we don't understand what's going on. And so then for all of us, I think my story becomes very relatable, that when Jesus promises to be with us always, and he promises a peace that surpasses understanding, even in the middle of the worst circumstances, that is actually true.
Yeah.
And that you don't have to go through a near-death experience for that to be true in your own life.
Yeah.
That Jesus wants to meet you right where you're at, in the day-to-day moments, whether they're big, giant moments like that or really small moments, that Jesus actually is with you. And it's not just this ethereal concept of, oh, yeah, Jesus is with, like, no, he is with
you. Really with you.
Yeah. And he loves you and is for you. And you might not understand how that for you always works or why some things are happening. But if you can trust him in the moments, I really do believe that you'll be able to look back and see how he was with you and how he was working. And so,
that's great.
So I don't want people to hear my story and be like, well, that's really crazy and cool for him. It actually is all of our stories that Jesus meets us in the middle of our pain, in the middle of our circumstances, and promises to never leave us.
I'm so glad you said that. The number of seniors I've met with when we're talking through senior testimonies that have told me, I've prayed for something crazy to happen. Caleb, I don't have a story. What story could I tell my peers?
Yeah.
That's such a great point to make. Jesus is with you just as much as he was with the Caleb Carmichael who has this crazy story.
Yeah.
That's great.
And you know, and I could, if we had time, we could talk, I could talk all about all of these really small moments in my life.
The mundane stuff.
The mundane stuff where Jesus was with me and it changed things in my life.
Yep.
And those stories, I think, are even more powerful than a crazy story like mine because it makes it much more relatable. So
yeah, for sure.
Sam, my wife, would say something similar. She's like, I didn't have some big crazy story, but when she tells people her story of faith is she'll tell it, frame it as, you know, I didn't go from being a bad person to a good person when I started following Jesus. I went from a dead person to someone who was alive.
I love that.
And that's true for all of us
who
have faith in Jesus. So
absolutely. Well, Caleb, appreciate you, dude.
Hey, man, it's so fun.
Thank
so
you
glad
for,
to be here.
Yeah, coming on, sharing your story. Students, if you got questions, let us know, and we'll talk to you soon.